TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Extinction Rebellion, Rupert Reed and Alison Green. In part one of this program, you heard from Dr. Rupert Reed, co-founder of Extinction Rebellion in the fall of 2018 in England. Extinction Rebellion runs parallel in time and demands to the school strike movement that has also already spread to over 100 countries. In an open letter signed by Vandana Shiva, Naomi Klein, Noam Chomsky, Bill McKibben, and many more, Extinction Rebellion states, quote, "The climate crisis is worsening much faster than previously predicted. Every single day, 200 species are becoming extinct. This desperate situation can't continue. Political leaders worldwide are failing to address the environmental crisis. International political organizations and national governments must foreground the climate emergency issue immediately, urgently drawing up comprehensive policies to address it." End quote. The goal of Extinction Rebellion is to use nonviolent resistance to bring about radical change to prevent climate collapse, loss of biodiversity, and to reduce the risk of human extinction. Here is Dr. Rupert Reed presenting these demands in more detail. He spoke on February 6, 2019, at the University of East Anglia.
Here's the demands of Extinction Rebellion. In simple terms, demand number one is tell the truth. And what we all need to do, the government to tell the truth. That's why also I was so passionate last year in trying to get the BBC to start telling the truth on climate and not featuring the absolute absurdities of climate change deniers any longer as balance. And the BBC have really changed their ways quite a lot over the last year. They're still way short of where they need to be, but they've gone quite a long way in the right direction. Let's keep pushing them in that direction. Anyway, demand number one says, get the government to tell the truth. Demand number two says, we want to reduce carbon emissions in the UK to net zero by 2025. Wow, that is a real target. That is a serious ambition. If the Paris Agreement were to say something like that, then it would have some credibility in terms of actually rising to the task that we face. It's absolutely eye-watering. How would something like that be done? You couldn't do something like that by just switching to electric cars or something. Reducing to zero by 2025 in a country like this, it means things like just shutting down a whole load of power stations. It means things like just melting down a whole load of cars and turning them into something else. It doesn't mean we have to go back to living in caves. You know, don't accept any rubbish like that if anyone says to you, oh, you want us to go living in caves and sit around a candle. It's so boring. They say the same thing over and over. It's always a cave and a candle. Doesn't mean that. We can still have plenty of renewable energy and so on and so forth, but it's going to mean big changes in our way of life. It's going to mean a lot of our existing infrastructure is just going to have to go. As I say, industrial growth society as we know it is at an end. The only question is it going to be ended by an enraged nature destroying it, or is it going to be ended by us voluntarily in an action, in an extraordinary action of rapid transformation? And the third demand is very interesting. The third demand says conventional democracy has failed. What we need to do is have some kind of citizens' assembly or citizens' assemblies picked at random from the public, like juries are picked at random from the public, and then given education and helpful support and so on. We need citizens' assemblies to be involved in making the decisions about how we go about doing all of this. We need to take it out of, to some extent at least, of the hands of professional politicians and professional civil servants and get the people involved. I think this is a very exciting and important part of what Extinction Rebellion is calling for. And Extinction Rebellion, as we've heard, is doing stuff locally as well. There's yours truly at the first nonviolent direct action that we did here in Norwich, where we occupied this exhibition that the council had where they were trying to tell people about this wonderful new road that they want to build. They want to build a road across this beautiful valley near here, the Wensum Valley, and basically destroy the peace and calm of it and destroy much of the wildlife and, of course, create loads of new journeys, loads of new cars, at the exact time when we need to be massively reducing our carbon emissions. It's completely absurd, total lack of vision. So we achieved a pretty remarkable and really quite positive set of media coverages out of it. And it's not just Extinction Rebellion, by the way. I want to mention one other thing that's happening right now, which is also very exciting, of this kind of radical, unprecedented nature. Some of you may recognize the young woman on the left. She's called Greta Thunberg. She's a Swedish school student, and she started a strike because of climate change. She said, why should I go to school if the education that I'm getting is going to be irrelevant because society is going to fall apart by the time I'm middle-aged? And at first it was just her. Things have changed a bit since then. 30,000 young people. This is just one of many, many demonstrations taken to the streets. Most of those are school students. Now, one thing that's really exciting about this, some of you probably know some children, some of you probably have some children. There is a starting now of the School Strike for Climate movement here in this country. So if you know a kid or if you have a kid, I would suggest to you say something subversive to them. Yeah? Say to them, yeah, you know, why should you go to school every single day to be taught this irrelevant stuff if society is going to fall apart by the time you're old? It's a horrible thing that we have to contemplate saying this kind of thing to our children. It's abominable. But that is the situation we are now in. And we're starting to get to a situation where we're getting inspired by the leadership of young people who are willing to face up to this. So this, I think, goes right alongside what's happening in Extinction Rebellion. All right, so that was number five. We need to rebel. Number six, we need to talk, because it's really, really important that we get to discuss about this. This is not a topic where it makes any sense at all to have a lecture and then to just go straight off back to your own home by yourself. You need to talk. We need to talk about this, because this stuff needs to be processed emotionally, rationally, practically. It needs to not be something that gets stuck inside your head. For far too long, that's a situation that far too many of us have been in. I think that many people have been in a situation for quite a long time of kind of having this set of worries at a low level, but not really fully addressing it. We're trying to find ways of kind of coping with it that involve things like, you know, trying to study it a bit and share your worries a bit, but not too much. You don't want to make people too worried themselves. You don't want to sound like you're some kind of kook. Well, you're not a kook. This is real. And my experience is that since I started giving this kind of talk, it's actually been hugely liberating for me and hugely liberating for quite a lot of people that I've talked to. It took me a long time to get to the point of being willing to give this kind of talk, because I was so intimidated by all the voices that were saying for so many years, you must remain optimistic, you mustn't put people off, people are going to be demoralized, people are going to be angry with you, etc. I was worried that I'd be attacked in public for giving this kind of talk at all. My actual experience has been very, very different. That over and over again, what people have said to me is, oh, thank God, we can actually be honest about this now. We can actually start facing it. We can actually start talking about it among ourselves. So that's what we need to do.
That was the conclusion of a speech by Dr. Rupert Weed, co-founder of Extinction Rebellion. Just days before producing this segment of TUC Radio, I came across an interview by scientist Dr. Rob Muir from oceanriver.org. He spoke to Dr. Rupert Weed and Dr. Allison Green, also a co-founder of Extinction Rebellion. Here are some of the highlights of their conversation.
Rupert Weed is going to be with us, and Rupert is a reader of philosophy at the University of East Anglia, chair of the UK-based think tank Greenhouse, and a former Green Party of England and Wales councillor, spokesperson, European parliamentary candidate, and national parliamentary candidate as well. Our other guest is Dr. Allison Green, is a UK cognitive psychologist in the area of human learning and skill acquisition. Allison is the former pro vice chancellor at Arden University. So, but I got to ask you for the public, why former?
Hi, everyone. Former because I took a very large decision a couple of months ago to resign from my post and swap academia for full-time activism.
Yeah, it's just remarkable. You know, because I look at your resume and you've been doing all these steps, getting higher and higher and doing more and more in academia, and then you just stepped away. Why?
I guess I had a kind of epiphany a couple of years ago, and I got to a point in my career where suddenly I realized that actually the career didn't really matter, and what really mattered to me was putting myself into something that I actually believe in and something that enabled me to maintain my integrity. I wanted to leave the system, basically. I wanted to extricate myself from the current economic system as best I could, and do something that I can believe in.
And so what did you come up with to do?
Well, I became involved with Extinction Rebellion, which began its life formally late last year, although the ideas had been in development with the key founders of the group for quite some time. So that's Roger Hallam and Gail Bradbrook, I think, are the two people that were most closely associated with Extinction Rebellion. These guys really motivated and inspired me and led me to want to work with them and to bring about social change.
Yes, exactly. And so that's why you're featured on this show to talk about the Extinction Rebellion.
It started some time ago, I think, with Gail primarily, who had been an activist and who had been trying to facilitate and encourage mass civil disobedience. And then last year, things seemed to gel. And so in October, on October 31st last year, there was a declaration in London, and this was then followed by a number of events in London. The movement is unusual in that it's grown remarkably quickly, but it has at its core some principles that I think will resonate really with a lot of people. And they're things like telling the truth about climate and the ecological emergency, you know, and I think most people can identify with that because, you know, the truth is absolutely fundamental. You know, what is wrong with telling the truth? A second requirement is that the government enacts legally binding policy measures. And then a third one is that we bring about a citizens' assembly to oversee changes as part of a sort of creating a democracy. And those are the three core principles that I think have really sparked the imagination of a lot of people, from academics to young people to grandparents. They're the kinds of things that people can really believe in.
Can I just add that the demand for legally binding policy measures is the precise demand in the UK context, and I think it would be similar in the US context, is for this country to go carbon net zero by 2025. Which is an incredibly bold demand. It looks completely unrealistic according to the rules of the political system as we know it. It requires everything to be changed in a short space of time. But that is actually what we need. This is one of my favorite demands that we in Extinction Rebellion are making. We're saying, yes, everything has to change really fast. And that's why we need to do really radical things to get there. It's not going to happen if we just stick to the conventional political process. It's not going to happen if we just stick to trying to vote for the best candidates at elections. That can help, but it isn't going to get us to zero carbon by 2025. So I think that demand of the Extinction Rebellion really concentrates the mind and really shows why we need to be engaging in mass civil disobedience. So non-violence is completely central to the movement. And as Alison just said, also, we want democracy. We want real democracy. We're saying that representative democracy as we know it has failed. So let's have some citizens' democracy. Let's have some sortition is the technical term for it. It's like what you do with a jury. A jury is selected at random from members of the public. We should have a citizens' assembly like that, where people are selected at random to represent us all, as a jury does. And then they're given some help and some education and some information and facilitated in deliberating about what we should do. Frankly, they couldn't do any worse than the current bunches of politicians we've got in our countries. So let's give that kind of radical version of democracy, let's give that kind of idea a chance.
So that means you have to be open to diverse approaches to getting there. You're not just all walking step in the same, you know, kind of together. I mean, that you're trying to be a big tent, right, and involve different views and stuff?
Yeah, and you're trying to open to new and radical possibilities. Of course, a lot of what we do is going to have to be done by really, really working together more closely together than we ever have done before. We have to want to do that. We have to do it more or less voluntarily. That's what real democracy means, and that's part of what Extinction Rebellion wants to facilitate, real democracy and nonviolent rule of the people, by the people, for the people.
Oh, over to you, Isabel. I have a question.
Alison, you mentioned earlier that there were some events organized in London. Can you tell us the first big actions taken there as part of the Extinction Rebellion mission and movement?
And for me, this was a first too. So I participated in what we're calling the Bridges event. And this took place on November 17th in London. And, you know, this was a big ambition. So the plan was that people would descend upon London and we would arrange ourselves on five bridges simultaneously. And then when a signal was given, we would then just swarm into the roads and we would just stop. We would simply stop the traffic. And, you know, for a lot of people there, you know, I was there on the day on Waterloo Bridge. I know Rupert was there too. Being there and actually talking with the people about why they were there and their motivations and what mattered to them was, you know, was really quite an incredible experience. You know, the UK hasn't seen this kind of action, this kind of commitment from normal people to simply congregate and to actually take action, non-violent action, in this particular way. We haven't seen this kind of thing in a long, long time. So it was quite an experience, I have to say, you know, to actually just be there and then to look across the Thames, across to the other bridges. The atmosphere was quite euphoric in a way, which sort of seems somehow not quite appropriate for an event that was a very serious event. I mean, these were people who are passionate, absolutely passionate about what's happening in the UK and across the globe, and who are saying, you know, we've had enough. We are going to rise up and we are going to make ourselves heard. It was a very empowering experience from my perspective. I mean, Rupert, I know you were there. Perhaps you want to say something too?
Yeah, well, my experience was very similar. I was on Lambeth Bridge and I was helping to try to sort of organise the taking of the bridge. The atmosphere before we tried to go into the road, frankly, it was pretty nervous. I was really quite uncertain that it was going to work out. And then Roger Hellam, who was on Lambeth Bridge with me and one or two of the others, started walking out into the road. He just started strolling into the road and then we all started following. And we just found how incredibly easy it was for hundreds of us to occupy this bridge and stop the traffic, bring central London to a standstill, reduce economic activity, and how the police couldn't really stop us because there were so many of us. And as you say, Alison, part of the atmosphere was, as a result of this, euphoria. It's like, wow, we can do it. 6,000 people took nonviolent civil disobedience and occupied the bridges of central London. And if we've done that once, well, we can do it again, and we can do it again on an even larger scale. And that is indeed what we're planning to do in April.
Yeah, and I recommend people go to your website.
The correct website address is simply rebellion.earth.
If you want to follow along with what Alison and Rupert are talking about, it's a great site to visit. Oh, Alison, you had an event that involved burying a coffin?
It did. So November 17th was really a very symbolic event. It was about expressing feelings, expressing anger. The following event on November 24th in Parliament Square was really, it was a grieving event. It was where people came together to talk about their feelings, to talk about how we feel about, you know, the loss of the Arctic sea ice, the loss of so many species. Oh, you know, it's tragic to how we feel about the forthcoming loss of even more species. And Skeena Rathore has been, in many ways, you know, the heart and soul of Extinction Rebellion. And she talked very passionately and emotionally about how one of the hardest things she'd had to do was explain to her teenage daughter that she might not have the longevity that she would wish for. And hearing these impassioned speeches from various people, Rupert spoke too, it was incredibly moving. And it culminated in there was a march and there was also a symbolic burial of a coffin. These kinds of actions where people talk about, you know, about feelings, where there's a deep kind of spiritual core to the movement. This is incredibly unusual. This hasn't really been seen mm-hmm. before.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think this is a unique dimension of Extinction Rebellion. We're giving people a space, which is so needed, for the expression of feelings of grief and loss and terror. And these things have been suppressed in the environmental movement far too often. The environmental movement for far too long has said things like, oh, we have to be optimistic. We always have to give people something positive to look towards. And it means that we've been very inauthentic often in the environmental movement. The Extinction Rebellion is blowing through all of that. We're saying, stuff that. Let's be honest. It's time to tell the truth, which is the demand we're also making, as Alison said, of the government. So we had better do it ourselves. It's time to tell the truth about our fears. It's time to tell the truth about our feelings. It's time to tell the truth about what we want. And what we actually find is that liberates people and empowers people to become much stronger and much less fearful. And it leads people, for example, to make the extraordinary, brilliant decision that Alison has made, which has really made me think, I must tell you, of chucking in this amazing job that she has so that she can try to do the right thing for the future of the planet. It's a liberation that's going along with this kind of authenticity and this facing of the reality of what we've done. You know, the horrendous fact that during my lifetime, we have exterminated half of wildlife on Earth. Mind-blowing, terrible fact. If you don't feel really sad when you hear that statistic, there's something wrong with you. So there has to be a place in our movement for that sadness. And in Extinction Rebellion, there definitely has been. And November the 24th, as Alison says, was a superb expression of that. It's called Rebellion Day 2, if people want to look it up on the internet.
I think, Hunter, we got a question. We also hit on the idea of doing things at a local level. Do you guys want to talk about what Extinction Rebellion is doing with local communities?
It's important to understand that Extinction Rebellion is quite a decentralist organization. So local groups, local affinity groups, and local groups generally have a strong right to do whatever they want, provided they stay within the overall frame of the principles of Extinction Rebellion and especially the fundamental method of nonviolence. So where I live in Norwich, we've been very active. We occupied and blocked a exhibition where the local council were trying to promote a horrible new climate dangerous road that they want to build. We nonviolently protested there and effectively blocked this exhibition from happening. We've also been working hard to try to persuade our local councils to declare a climate emergency, which is happening as a result of Extinction Rebellion in more and more places around Britain and, in fact, around the world. These local events are happening all over the place, as Alison says, more and more of them. And then there are also going to be the big national and indeed international events, with the key one being on April the 15th, which everyone is working towards.
Alison, there was a letter from academics that you could maybe start us off on, and then Rupert could comment on that as well.
Yeah, one of the things that I think has been hugely effective in terms of getting Extinction Rebellion on the radar and bringing awareness to it was the initial letter that Rupert, Richard House and I composed. If you look at it, it's on the Guardian website. It's very visceral, you know, because we are all, the three of us, incredibly passionate about what's happening and what's not happening. And just how important it is that, you know, that action is taken. And so being academics, you know, we thought, well, academics need to have a voice. You know, the public trust, they trust academics, they tend to trust experts. So we reached out to our academic networks across a huge number of different disciplines. So we weren't reaching out simply to climate scientists. We were reaching out to people from the arts and the humanities, sciences and theology, philosophy, you know, a broad church. It was remarkable because, you know, people would you know, willingly sign up, many of them saying, fantastic, you know, we really support what you're doing. It's about time. We've needed this. And that letter was really a turning point for Extinction Rebellion. It was cathartic. It's proven to be a catalyst. It's had that letter has had some 16,000 downloads, I think, from The Guardian, which is, you know, if you think of it, this is it in one sense, it's just a letter. In another sense, I think it marked a point at which academics were saying, we are no longer sitting on the fence. You know, we are standing up and we're going to make our voices heard.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we then followed that up with a second letter in December, which was an international letter, which was again headed up by Alison and Richard House and myself. And this international letter had a lot of signatories that your listeners will recognize, people like Vandana Shiva, Naomi Klein, Noam Chomsky, Philip Pullman, Bill McKibben, Jonathan Porritt, Lily Cole, Chris Packham, a real retinue of international stars of the green movement and of broadcasting and of media and of dissent. And what this international letter did was follow on the initial letter and say, look, this obviously is something of concern to us around the world. And around the world, we need organizations, we need movements like Extinction Rebellion to be taking off in a big way if we are to have a future. It really is as simple and as blunt as that. We're delighted that these letters seem to have had this kind of involving and catalyzing effect upon people. And that's part of the reason, I think, why we are seeing this extraordinary international development of Extinction Rebellion. I think officially now there are groups in 127 countries, which is really quite incredible. And what we're hoping, among other things, is that in the US, Extinction Rebellion is really going to grow and take off in the next few months and hopefully rise to the kind of level that it's already risen to in Britain.
Let's kick back a bit. And Rupert, tell us about kind of the philosophical underpinnings of this whole kind of these kind of endeavors of trying to repair nature and how complicated it all is. And
well, there's so much to say here, but let me just mention a couple of key things. Firstly, as we've already implied, and this is a very important point, the Extinction Rebellion is not just about dangerous man-made climate change. It's not just about climate breakdown. It's about the wider ecological crisis, of which climate breakdown is simply the biggest and most immediately existentially threatening symptom for us, for humans. But we have to remember that actually the extinction crisis and the biodiversity crisis are hitting already the planet unbelievably hard and rendering other species extinct at an almost unprecedented rate. And this is all down to us, and mostly not down to climate, actually. It's mostly down to habitat destruction and sheer human numbers and level of human consumption and production and pollution more generally. Extinction Rebellion is concerned about the possible extinction of the human race and the actual extinction of other beings across our planet. And we want absolutely to stop both of these things.
That was, again, the voice of Dr. Rupert Read. Before him, Dr. Alison Green, both co-founders of Extinction Rebellion. A much longer version of this interview is posted on the podcast page of oceanriver.org. Dr. Rupert Read teaches philosophy at the University of East Anglia. He's a longtime Green Party politician and a former Green Party spokesperson for transportation. Dr. Alison Green was most recently pro-vice chancellor at Arden University. Last year, she made the transition from academic to activist. She co-wrote the open letter from Extinction Rebellion that was published in The Guardian. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.